Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Ms. Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say the menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
You're back in the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle and KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles. I'm your host, Al Warren, and Kev Thompson's there.
Hey, Al, from the road.
Yeah, he's on the road.
The man on the street.
He's the man on the street. He is at the hurricane right now. No. Oh, I'm going to get hate mail for that.
Literally on the street, though.
Yeah, literally on the streets. Okay. Now, today we are talking, we're going into history today, and we're going to be talking about the Knights Templar. And joining us is an author of, I believe, 7, maybe 8 books on this subject. We'll find out. So, welcome, David S. Brody.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Wow. Let's get into this. How did you get such an interest to write all these books and to get into the Knights Templar?
Yeah, so about a dozen years ago, my daughter was in 4th or 5th grade at the time and came home and said to me, "Dad, we heard a story in school today about explorers who were here in America before Christopher Columbus." And I said, "Oh, do you mean the Vikings?" And she said, "No, Prince Henry Sinclair." And I said, "Well, who is that?" And so we live outside of Boston in a town called Westford, and we have a legend in Westford that Prince Henry Sinclair, a Scottish nobleman, sometime in the late 1390s, essentially followed the path of the Vikings over to maritime Canada and continued down the coast into inland Massachusetts, where he landed and climbed a hill here in Westford, Massachusetts. And so we have a legend called the Westford Knight Legend, and that legend is that one of Sinclair's men died while he was here, and he carved an effigy into the rock ledge to memorialize that knight, and that effigy is still visible today. And the reason that's so interesting for our conversation today is it turns out the Sinclair family have a long history with the Knights Templar, and many people believe the Templar treasure ended up in Scotland, in Roslyn, with the Sinclair family. The family later built Roslyn Chapel, made famous in the Da Vinci Code. So we have all this interesting history here in my hometown relating back to the Sinclairs and the Knights Templar and their possible treasure. So again, about 12 years ago, I sort of went down that rabbit hole researching this matter, and I figured if there's, you know, if it's true, there should be other evidence. And for a dozen years, I've been kicking around in the dusty corners of history, in desperate need of a shower and a change of clothes. Again, it's been 12 years since I've been down that rabbit hole. But in that time, I found a lot of evidence indicating, yes, indeed, there were explorers here. Yes, they did have ties to the outlawed Knights Templar. And I've written, like you said, seven, and as of tomorrow or the next day, eight books will be have come out on this subject.
That's
so
it's
my passion. My kids call me the rock nerd because I'm out in the woods all the time looking for rock carvings and whatnot. But it's what I love. It's what I do.
Well, that's good. It sounds it. It comes out. Now, your daughter, she mustn't have been going to school in the States then.
No, she was here in Massachusetts,
and she learned.
And again,
that.
only because it's a local legend, only because of this particular town. You know, this is not stuff that's taught in most elementary schools. But they had a storyteller come in that day, and again, because we have a town marker, and there's a tourist site here in the town, and so people know about it. And we're probably the only town in America that teaches this right now. But it happened to be that's where we live. And even though I'm a lawyer by trade, I'm a fiction writer by avocation. So I like to say that when I look at this stuff, you know, as a lawyer, normally I don't care about things like truth and facts. but as a fiction, and you guys are a conspiracy radio show, so you can appreciate that. But as a fiction writer, the facts matter, the truth matters, because if I'm going to write this stuff and I'm going to expect readers to invest their time and money in my books, you know, I got to bring something to the table. I better bring hard evidence about this. I can't just sort of wave my magic wand and say, people were here 100 years before Columbus. No, they want to see evidence. And so, you know, it's almost like selling the story to a jury. My readers are my jury. And again, so I went out looking for evidence, and I figured if these guys really were here in 1398, 1399, and they really did carve this effigy on a rock ledge in Westford, there should be other evidence. You know, if there's not, it's probably not a legitimate story. But if there is, and we can start piecing this together using different disciplines, not just geology and archaeology, but cartography and linguistics and DNA evidence and, you know, all sorts of different disciplines, if we can link this all together, we can create a tapestry that tells a story. And that's really what's happened in the past dozen years or so.
Fake news.
Fake news. now, David, you mentioned this effigy. What is it? What is the effigy, and what sets it apart that says Templar other than anything else?
So there's an effigy that we can see. The carving that we can see today, and the carving today clearly depicts a medieval battle sword. Picture Mel Gibson in Braveheart, you know, it's early 1300s, and cut your head off type of thing, a hand and a half, a claymore. That's clearly there. What may also be there, and this, we have photographs going back to the 1930s and 40s showing this pretty clearly, would be the rest of the effigy, the knight himself, his helmet, his shoulders, his shield. It's the coat of arms on the shield that ties us back to the Gunn clan, which in turn ties us to the Sinclairs, and it's the Sinclair association with the Templars, which sort of puts this whole thing together. And again, we get into other artifacts later on. But as far as the story goes, Prince Henry Sinclair, this is the 1390s, his grandfather was a Knight Templar. But going back even earlier to the early years of the 12th century, the nine founding members of the Knights Templar, one of them was married to a Sinclair woman. And so for about 200 years, we have this close association between the Templars and the Sinclair family. And then going forward, after the Templars were outlawed in 1307, and many of them, we think, ended up in Scotland, many historians believe the Templars reconstituted themselves as the Freemasons. And then we see this long association between the Sinclair clan and Scottish Rite Freemasonry, so close, in fact, that for a couple hundred years, the Sinclair clan were hereditary Grand Masters of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. That goes all the way up, I think, into the 1700s. So we have about a 500-year, 600-year span where we have this close association between this one family and the Templars going backwards and the Freemasons going forwards.
Wow. You got something?
Oh, yeah, just a follow-up there, Al. I apologize. Now, what is your take on the Freemasons' connection with the Templars? Do you think it's a legitimate? Do you think that we absorb them to protect them, or do you think that it's two individual things?
I think definitely the former. I think it's definitely the Templars were outlawed, and they reconstituted themselves as the Freemasons. You know, we like to talk about how in the 1960s federal statutes were anti-racketeering statutes were passed to outlaw the mafia. Well, the mafia didn't go away. They went underground. They reconstituted themselves. They're still around 50 years later. Same thing with the Templars. The King of France and the Pope outlawed the Templars, but they didn't go away. They reconstituted themselves. They renamed themselves. They relocated themselves. But there was it was too important and powerful an organization just to disappear because of some edict that was signed by a king in France. So I think it's very clear if you look at the symbology and allegory of Freemasonry that much of it has its roots in the Knights Templar. And you can just walk into a Masonic lodge and just listen and watch for a while. I'm not a Freemason myself, but I spend a decent amount of time lecturing in these lodges. And you can't help but notice similarities between the two organizations.
Now, just for the listeners and stuff, who were the Knights Templar, and how did they begin?
Sure. So the Templars were formed in the early parts of the 1100s, the early 12th century. The Crusades had started perhaps 20 years earlier, and parts of Jerusalem were retaken by the Christians. But Christian pilgrims coming from Europe to Jerusalem were oftentimes attacked or assaulted or robbed on their way to and from the Holy Land. And so the Templars, their purported reason for organizing themselves was to protect the travelers back and forth from Jerusalem to Israel, Jerusalem to Europe, pardon me. In reality, the nine French noblemen who founded the order spent most of the first decade in Jerusalem digging under King Solomon's Temple, the old Temple of Jerusalem, King Solomon's Temple, the King Herod had destroyed late in the first century. And they dug, and many historians believe they found the remnants of the Knights Templar treasures that had been buried and secreted underneath that temple at the time of the uprising. And whatever they found, they came back to Europe 10 or 15 years later and almost instantly became one of the most powerful forces in Christendom. They controlled vast swaths of land. They ended up with huge amounts of money. Whatever it was they found, they somehow leveraged it into amazing amounts of power in a very, very quick amount of time within one generation. And it came to the point where they were as powerful or even more powerful than any king in Europe. And this went on for about 200 years during the entire span of the Crusades. And then eventually Europe, the Christian countries of Europe lost the Crusades, and the Arabs and the Muslims took over Jerusalem again. And at that point, the Templars were still in existence, but the King of France realized that they were a very powerful force located right in Paris and a threat to him. And the Pope felt similarly, perhaps because the Templars had sort of a different version of Christianity they had developed. And the King and the Pope together decided what better way to get rid of your enemies than to outlaw them. And so on Friday the 13th of October, which is the date for, and 1307, which is the genesis of unlucky Friday the 13th, the edict was signed and the Templars were rounded up and many of their leaders arrested and eventually killed, you know, burned alive or hung. But all of this goes back to the early years where whatever they found in Jerusalem, whatever they found under King Solomon's Temple, it must have been really important. It could have been religious relics. It could have been religious treasures, things like the Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail. It could have been secrets of ancient Christianity, things that the church didn't want known about, the true teachings of early Christianity. Or it could have just been gold and other riches. We're not really sure what it was. But, again, whatever it is, they were able to leverage it into huge amounts of power pretty quickly.
I think what makes the story of the Templars even more tragic is the way they were executed. I mean, they were charged with tons of bogus crimes, you know, such as desecration of, you know, holy relics. And, you know, we saw them consorting with Lucifer at midnight and it almost like later witch hunts.
That's a very good analogy. That's exactly what it was like. But I think that there's probably a germ of truth to some of the accusations of heresy. I do think that if we think about the time period, the Dark Ages had just ended in Europe. the Templars, they're educated noblemen, they go to Europe, and it must have been eye-opening to have such an advanced society. We think of the Middle East as being sort of backwards compared to Europe today, but back then it was the other way around. The Middle East was far more advanced while Europe was in the Dark Ages. So, again, these French noblemen, they go to the Middle East, to Jerusalem, and they start to learn about modern medicine and modern science, architecture, navigation, concepts such as individual liberty and freedom. And they brought a lot of that back with them to Europe. And you can imagine that the church wasn't thrilled with that kind of stuff. The church had a good thing going with people being ignorant. They liked the idea that if you were sick, you didn't go to a doctor, you went to your priest, you gave a donation, and he prayed for you to make you well. That was better for the church than what the Templars brought back, which is modern medicine. And so there was definitely a clash between the Templars, who had sort of had their eyes open when they were in Europe, they're sophisticated, and the church. And part of that also, I believe, was that one of the things that the Templars learned when they were in the Middle East, in Jerusalem, was that the version of Christianity that the church was selling wasn't really the version of Christianity that was founded by Jesus, you know, 11 or 1200 years earlier. And of course, that's going to cause accusations of heresy. So there may have been some germs of truth into the idea that the Templars were practicing maybe an older, quote unquote, purer version of Christianity than what the church wanted to promote. The whole patriarchal, the church is always right, you need to pray through your priest, not directly to God, that kind of stuff.
Well, here, let's theorize then, because this is exciting. Maybe, here's the theory, what they found was either A, the Ark of the Covenant, or B, writings. You know, because remember, later on we found tons of writings in Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe they found an earlier version that maybe, let's just go crazy here, maybe was written by Jesus himself or, you know, Mary Magdalene. I mean, we don't know, but maybe you're right. They found something, and I want to believe so bad that it was the Ark or perhaps, you know, the cup. But maybe it was the writings that brought everything back.
I happen to agree with you. I think it would be much more exciting and bigger headlines if it was the Ark of the Covenant or the Cup of the Holy Grail. But I think probably the most likely reality is that they found ancient writings, as you just said, that were contradictory to what the church was teaching. It may have been they found writings that indicated, yes, Jesus and Mary Magdalene were indeed married, and she did indeed have his children. No big deal at the time. Every rabbi, and don't forget Jesus was a rabbi, was expected, in fact, required to be married. So that wouldn't have been surprising at the time. Of course, the church didn't want that coming out during the medieval times. It may have been, and one of the Dead Sea Scrolls talks about how the prophecy at the time was that there would be two messiahs, a priestly messiah and a kingly messiah, Jesus
Warrior.
Being the king and John the Baptist being the priest, and that these two messiahs were supposed to share power. This is one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, John the Baptist was eventually beheaded by King Herod, and so he was unable to fulfill his role as the priestly Messiah. One of the things the Templars were always accused of was worshiping this head, Baphomet. It may have been that the head of John the Baptist was what the Templars were worshiping, because they were familiar with this prophecy that it was supposed to be a dual two people sitting on the throne, the king and the priest, a duality. And so that, yes, they worship Jesus, but they also worship John the Baptist, and that may have been why they were accused of kissing that skull, that head. It may have been that they were able to uncover the head of John the Baptist while they were in Jerusalem. And they, again, they knew of this prophecy. They knew of this idea of a priestly Messiah as well as a kingly one.
Wow. Wow. That, you know, you are the first person that has ever been able to explain that. And it makes sense. I never thought of that. Cause who was it that had John the Baptist beheaded?
Well, it was King Herod. And the whole story was,
yes,
John the Baptist criticized King Herod's marriage. It was a second marriage. It was an illegal marriage. He criticized it. Herod's new wife, her daughter is the famous Oh, no, I'm blocking on the Dance of the Seven Veils. Can you guys help me on that?
Salome,
okay. And Salome danced for the king, and he was so impressed by her dance, her seductive dance, the Dance of the Seven Veils, that he said to her, I'll give you anything you want. And so she said to her mother, what do we want? And the mother said, we want John the Baptist's head, because he's criticizing my marriage to the king.
On a silver platter.
Exactly, on a silver platter. So Salome says, I want John the Baptist's head on a silver platter. And the king's like, all right, I promise you whatever you want. And so he gets beheaded, and that's the head. And then they put the body out for the vultures to feast on, but the skull never was found. And so that's why many people think the Templars eventually ended up with the skull. But it may have been this worship the Templars had of John the Baptist that caused them to butt heads with the church later on. In these books I've written, the first book is called Cabal of the Western Knight, and it focuses on a lot of the things, the artifacts, the Templar artifacts in New England. But the second book is called The Thief on the Cross, and it focuses on the Templar worship of John the Baptist. So readers who are interested in that particular angle want to grab Thief on the Cross. We'll talk probably more about the artifacts and Cabal of the Western Knight as we go along. But that I was fascinated, just as you were, I think it was Kevin who said that, just as you were fascinated by that whole idea of, why did the Templars worship this head? What was going on there? And when we figure out the John the Baptist connection, it all sort of starts to make sense.
Mm. Well, now, I thought Kevin was on a roll.
I'm making some owl time here.
I was interested in how you tied them to coming to the U.S. and what was the point of them coming here?
Right. So we get, it's 1307. The Templars are outlawed. They flee. Some of them end up in Portugal and reconstitute themselves as the Knights of Christ. Many of them end up in Scotland because at the time Robert the Bruce, who ruled Scotland, had been excommunicated from the church, and so they found safe haven in Scotland. In fact, there's some pretty strong evidence that they helped Robert the Bruce in his Battle of Bannockburn against the English. Again, this is back to Mel Gibson in Braveheart, that whole story. And that Robert the Bruce was so thankful to them that he gave them safe haven. Wherever they ended up, they obviously took their treasures with them. And again, with treasures, are we talking gold and silver? Definitely that. Are we talking religious artifacts? Probably that also. Are we talking secrets? Definitely that. Hidden knowledge, yes, all that stuff. Whatever they took. We know that when King Philip raided their treasury in Paris in 1307 after arresting them, it was empty. We're pretty sure that everything was carted to the coast and put aboard ships in La Rochelle, which is on the western coast of France, and that they sailed north. Many accounts have them going to Scotland. Okay, so we've got this Templar treasure in Scotland. They've got safe haven with Robert the Bruce. But they understand that that's going to change. The politics of Europe, of course, are always changing, quicksand-like, and that at any point the English might come in and invade, in which case the Pope now has jurisdiction again. So the Templars say, we've got these treasures. We've got to hide them. Where are we going to put them? So now we've got, let's go back to the Sinclair family, Prince Henry Sinclair, and I mentioned his connections with the Templars going backwards and the Freemasons going forward. What I didn't mention is that his mother was a Norse woman. So even though he was Scottish on his father's side, his mother was a Norse woman. And we can assume from that she had access to the old Viking charts and maps and their route across the North Atlantic, island hopping across the North Atlantic, eventually down to maritime Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that it was odd that we know that Leif Erikson came to North America in the year 1002 and that he left in around the year 1009. But that nobody came back again until Christopher Columbus almost 500 years later. And even as a kid, I thought that was strange because, let's face it, there are plenty of really good reasons to come back and forth once you knew the way. There were economic reasons. There was timber. If you're in a maritime society, the timber that you could have harvested in Maine and Nova Scotia would have been incredibly important. If you know anything about Greenland, for example, there is no timber anymore, and many areas of Europe had been deforested at the time. There was trade, of course, with the Native Americans. There was fishing, of course, not to mention just the idea of all this open land. And so I think what really happened throughout the late Middle Age period is that explorers came back and forth across the North Atlantic many times. They just kept it secret, just like you keep your favorite fishing hole secret. Prince Henry Sinclair, we know he had a fleet of ships. We know that it was his job to bring the bishops back and forth to Greenland on behalf of the Vatican. So we know he knew he had to get at least that far to Greenland. And again, his mother was a Norse woman, had an access probably to old Viking charts and maps. So it seems like not too big a stretch to have him continue on, much as the Viking forebears did, and continue down the coast, Labrador, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia. And then the legend is that he had 11 ships. He landed in Nova Scotia in 1398, and that 9 of the ships turned around and went back after spending the winter with the Mi'kmaq tribe. And the 2 ships continued down the coast to explore further. And it's these 2 ships, I think, that ended up in western Massachusetts, where Sir James Gunn, one of Sinclair's lieutenants, died. And the effigy that we have carved in the rock ledge is, we think, of Gunn. But again, as I said earlier, there's other artifacts, too. There's another artifact here in Westford. We call it the Boat Stone. It's a medieval ship carved into a stone, and it indicates the directions to where we think they spent their winter camping. It's about a mile away from the Westford Night carving. We've had that stone shipped out to a geologist in Minnesota by the name of Scott Walter, who many of your listeners might know from the History Channel.
Absolutely.
America on Earth, right. And Scott does some really interesting work with these stones. He does weathering studies, and he's able to determine how long these carved stones have been outside in the weathering environment based on the microscopic changes to the carved areas of the rock surface. And we sent this boat stone out to Minnesota a few years ago, and Scott's opinion was it had been sitting outside for about 600 years. So that's, you know, very consistent with the year 1400, 1398, 1399. So we have artifacts here in Westford. Again, I mentioned earlier that it's important that we not just use archaeology when we look at these things. We can bring in the geologists. We can bring in the cartographers. We can bring in the linguists. There's other areas, other disciplines that can take a look at these artifacts and this history and weigh in on it. And so up and down the coast of New England, we have, whether it's the Westford artifacts, we have rune stones, runic being a Scandinavian script. We have a rune stone in Maine that's dated at 1401 and 1402, and next to that, floorboards from a sod house that were carbon dated to 1406, plus or minus 5. So again, Native Americans obviously didn't speak runic. They weren't carving rune stones. They didn't have metal tools to do so. But we
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We have some kind of Scandinavian presence right around 1400. We have a round stone tower in Newport, Rhode Island, the Newport Tower, a fascinating structure. The mainstream historians claim it's a colonial windmill. It makes no sense as a colonial windmill. It's Romanesque architecture. It's built on 8 pillars. We've done some carbon dating of the mortar that indicates 1430 is a date plus or minus. There's a unique flue system in the fireplace that points directly to 14th century Scottish architecture. There's a lot of things about that tower which point right back not just to the Scots, but to the Templars. The format of that tower is very similar to other Templar architecture in Europe. So again, we've got 8 or 10 of these artifacts and sites around New England that all point to late 1300s and the Templars.
And the Vikings, as best evidenced by the Minnesota Vikings.
Right. Well, that's so the, you know, the Kensington Runestone, of course, is another one of those artifacts. It's a little earlier. It's about a generation earlier, 1362. But that's another stone that Scott Walter has analyzed and concluded that the weathering on that stone is such that it can't be a hoax. And now we're left with, did the Native Americans carve with metal tools speaking runic? It makes no sense. Or it is what it says it is, which is 8 Goths and 22 Norwegians on a voyage of acquisition in 1362. Now, why would you come to the middle of the country in 1362? Well, it says a voyage of acquisition. And during medieval times, if you wanted to claim land, you claim the headwaters. If you think about where that stone sits in northern Minnesota, it's basically the Continental Divide. And if you know anything about history, the Louisiana Purchase, all that land in the central part of the country going all the way down the Mississippi River, essentially the headwaters of all of that is very close to the Kensington Runestone. So if you wanted to make a claim to the central part of North America, almost the third of the continent, you could do that by going to that spot. So that makes sense. You know, when we're looking at this stuff, we don't have the smoking gun. So all we can do is build a case. This is where my legal training comes in handy. I'm trained to analyze and weigh evidence. And what we find is we have these theories that perhaps they came, you know, to the central part of the country. Does that make sense? Is that indeed the headwaters? Does that make sense? Is that indeed how you make land claims in medieval times? Yes, yes, yes. We keep finding that the evidence that comes in the door later supports the theory we had earlier. And that's one of the ways in the law that we test our conclusions. If the later evidence comes in and it's contradictory, we've got to start over again. But we're finding more and more artifacts and more history and more science that supports this general idea that in the latter part of the 14th century, there were these waves of Templar-related explorers coming not only to New England, but in the particular case, all the way to Minnesota.
Well, it makes strategic sense, too, and it's something that, you know, a group of military men would do. I want to claim the waterways because it's a choke point, and I can keep you from bringing supplies through if I control the water. If you come on land, then I can spread you out and more easily defeat you and defend my zone.
You're 100% correct, but take it one step further. They didn't fight their way to Minnesota, right? I mean, there's no way the Native Americans, the Iroquois, were too.
No, but they explored the Great Lakes, and their ships were designed for that type of water.
Right, but they had to have formed some kind of alliance, right? There's no way they fought their way to the interior. So now the question is, you know, we know later on that the Native Americans were relatively friendly originally to the Europeans when they came over. And I think that's because the first wave of Europeans, and I'm not talking about the Vikings, I'm talking about the Templar-related groups, I think the reason the Native Americans were welcoming to the Pilgrims is because they had a peaceful history with the Templar visitors a century or two earlier. The Templars were not here to settle and to take land. They were here to trade. They were here to hide some things. We talked about that already. But generally, they were here. They came in peace. And they had they treated Native Americans respectfully. Again, they knew about diplomacy. They had spent a lot of time in the Middle East. They weren't as close-minded to different cultures as we know the English later were. And so they were able to reach an understanding with the Native Americans and were given safe passage. And at our detriment, we ignore the Native American history side of this when we look at it. So I've made a point of befriending and spending time with Native American tribal chiefs here in New England and asking them, you know, what does your oral history tell you about this? What do you think of all this? And they've basically said, we are in complete agreement that this is what happened. Prince Henry Sinclair came with the Templars, built the Newport Tower. This is part of our oral history. So they've confirmed a lot of what we think had happened. But again, it all goes back to the idea that whoever came here had to have reached some kind of peaceful relationship, some kind of alliance with the Native American tribes.
So that's exciting and sad all at the same time, because it's exciting that this validates your theory, but it's sad that the answer has been sitting in front of us this whole time, and we ignore it because we ignore those people.
Right. Well, you know, the Native Americans, they keep their traditions and their histories orally. That's always been their way. The chief or the medicine woman or whoever would be in that particular tribe would pass on the tribe's history around the campfire to the next generation, and it would be memorized or memorized in the form of poetry or in the form of song, and that's how the memories were kept. And of course, I'm a writer, so I love the written word, and as a lawyer, I tend to be a little bit pedantic myself, but I also recognize that just because we happen to think the written word is so important doesn't mean other cultures have to behave the same way. And for a long time, we've looked at Native American oral history as being unreliable. You know, we all played telephone when we were kids, and that was the example to show how you can't really believe what you hear. But that's not what the Native Americans did. They weren't little kids playing games. They took it very seriously, and they memorized it, just as our prayers have been memorized and haven't really changed much in 2,000 years or 3,000 years, whatever it is, because they're important. You know, so too can the Native Americans keep their important traditions alive, and they're not going to be corrupted by this telephone game we talk about when we're 7 years old.
That's touche, because it's got to be written, it's got to be said, it's got to be given a certain way. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to rewind to something that you alluded to earlier. You said that you had linguists looking at this evidence, and I can't remember who, I want to say it was Scott Walter, made a very key discovery with the hooked X and has associated that with the Templars.
Right. So the hooked X is a runic character. Again, we've got the runestone in Minnesota, in Kensington. We've got another runic inscription in near Popham Beach, Maine, which is up near Bath on the Maine coast, and a third one in Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island called the Narragansett Runestone. All three of those runestones have a carved letter on them. The X is a common runic character, but all three of these stones have something called the hooked X. It's an X with an extra barb on the upper right side. That hooked X, that letter, does not exist on any runic inscription in Scandinavia or Europe. And Scott's conclusion, I think he's 100% correct on this, is that this is sort of a modification made by the medieval travelers, almost like their calling card, their slang, if you would, that just says, you know, they change the X as a way to identify themselves and identify themselves to future travelers who might come over and see those carved areas, carved stones and carved artifacts. And Scott's belief is that hooked X ties back to the Jesus and Mary Magdalene bloodline, which I'm not sure we want to get into that too much today, but the idea being that, again, it was a calling card. This is who we are, and this is why we came. And the fact that all three of the runestones, you know, they're separated by thousands of miles and were carved at least 100 years apart, the fact that all of them share this one unique runic character, where we don't find it anywhere in Europe or Scandinavia, to me it's pretty compelling. You know, it's not the way the world works normally, unless there's something going on there.
Yeah, something that only another Templar would know, would be able to identify.
Right. It tells us that those three artifacts were carved by the same people or group of people, you know, people with a common knowledge base, that it wasn't like three different groups randomly added the same barb to the X letter. That makes no sense.
No, it just like Masons, you know, there are certain indicators or certain things or certain signs or ways of standing, sitting, whatever, that only we would be able to identify.
Exactly. And so that's one of the examples of linguistic discoveries. But let me give you another one, because here in New England, we think when Prince Henry and his gang came, they came down the coast of New England along the Atlantic, and they stopped in Newburyport and got on the Merrimack River, came up the Merrimack, disembarked, and ended up in Westford. Okay, that's how we think they came, and we've got a carving of the entire river system on a boulder. We call it the Tingsboro Mapstone, which we think was carved by Sinclair and his group. But the Merrimack name is interesting because my Native American friends tell me that Merrimack is not a Native American word. And we think about the Templars, and of course, even though they butted heads with the church, they were still very religious. They were a monastic group, and of course, they worshiped Jesus. And we think about Scottish tradition of what the word Mac means, whether it's Mac in front or Mick in front. It means, obviously, son of. You guys know that, right?
Yeah.
You know, McDonald means son of Donald. So the Mary Mac River is the son of Mary River. Son of Mary, of course, is Jesus. So the Merrimack River, which the Native Americans say it's not a Native American name, well, where did that come from? I would postulate, because once the Europeans got here, it was already named the Merrimack. But the Native Americans said, we didn't name it that. It was somebody else named it. So here we go. So the Merrimack, you know, again, linguistically, that's a clue. The son of Mary River.
See, the Europeans come and they bring with them all their disease and alcohol. Now, one thing I wanted to go back to, for me, the amateur here, I wanted to know, so you said how the Templars were outlawed. What exactly did they do to outlaw them? Like, what did they charge them with? How could they just make them all arrested and go away? They had to have done something.
Well, again, the King of France, he was the motivating force behind this, and eventually the Pope agreed to it. They essentially drummed up charges of heresy, that the Templars were accused of spitting on the cross, of certain homosexual acts with each other, of
desecrating the statues of Mary. And
I'm sorry, what was that last thing?
Desecrating holy artifacts, you know, like statues of Mary. You know,
I hadn't
Jesus.
Heard that one, but that wouldn't surprise me. But essentially, they, you know, drummed up charges, similar to what happened during the Inquisition and similar to what happened during the witch trials. You know, essentially, back then, if you made an accusation and then you tortured somebody and they confessed, that was considered a legitimate confession. Well, of course, under extreme amounts of torture, people were going to agree pretty much to anything. So they never really got any of the Templars to admit to any of this. They never really had any evidence. And in fact, about 20 or 30 years ago, I might be wrong on this date, the church finally came out and said, you know what, all those confessions, all those convictions, they were wrong. It turns out the Templars really did not do anything illegal. Okay, so, you know, hundreds of years later, they're finally vindicated. But essentially what it was, and then probably the biggest reason for all this, I forgot to mention, is that the King of France owed the Templars vast amounts of money. And what better way to remove your debt than to kill your banker?
Yeah, so, that's a good idea.
By outlawing his banker, he essentially, not only did he hope to recover their treasures, but he was able to wipe out a huge amount of debt. So that was really probably the primary motivation he had to turn on them. And again, the church is willing to go along with it because the church didn't necessarily trust the Templars, and more importantly, didn't need the Templars anymore because the Crusades had been over. They'd been lost. And so the church didn't need this big army to go fight in the Middle East anymore, and the church was worried they were going to rabble-rouse here in Europe.
Yeah, yeah, have a big party. What do you think of the Knights, the series about them that's been out?
I've watched some of it. It's interesting entertainment, and I think it's good background. I still am surprised that not more of these shows explore what we're talking about today, which is the idea that the Templars came over and used America as a safe haven, because there's a lot of compelling evidence to show that they did. And to me, you know, we've got this in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and you know, we all learned that in second grade, but let's face it, we all got past the idea that the Easter Bunny was real. You know, we lived through that, okay, that trauma. We can live through the trauma of somebody being here before Columbus.
The Easter Bunny's not real?
I think it's just a question of time. Ah, sorry. Sorry to all little listeners out there. I think we can, and it might take a generation, because it takes a while to redirect the ocean liner. I get that. But I think this story, to me, is far more interesting and far more compelling than Columbus, who sort of, you know, just sort of stumbled his way here thinking he was going to Asia and ended up in Santo Domingo instead. That's not a very interesting story. And then once he got here, of course, he was, you know, a complete bastard to the Native Americans. This is a better story. This is a more noble story. These are people who came for a reason. They treated the Native Americans correctly. There's treasure, which everyone loves. There's intrigue. There's secrecy. I mean, this is a better story. Not to mention the fact I think it's true.
Yeah. What was the selection process to get to become a Templar? Like, how would you become one?
Usually it was men, middle-aged men, which, you know, back then, mid-30s, men who had had a family, because one of the requirements was celibacy. So you didn't want to join when you were, you know, you didn't want to join when you were 18. So typically it was men who had had a family, who wanted their souls to be saved, and honestly, I think, who wanted a little midlife adventure. Essentially, it was an excuse to go off to Europe and, you know, with your buddies and go kill some heathens and have your soul saved and come back and be a hero.
Get away from the wolf.
And, yeah, seriously. And, you know, go and probably do some, you know, some whoring along the way.
Yeah.
But essentially, that's a lot of what it was. It was a glorified golf weekend with the boys.
Wow.
But what I think, if I can amend Al's question, though, I mean, that would be for any man of that day. You know, I'm going to go deliver Jerusalem, you know, from these evil people. Okay, I understand that, but what separated the Templars from any other knight other than the chastity?
Yeah, so the Templars, because they were generally the noblemen. So it was traditional in Europe that, like, the third son would join the priesthood and whatever. This is different. These are guys who were noblemen, who had vast amounts of wealth, who had other careers, whether it was just being, you know, a lord or whatever, but who joined later in life. And so this was almost like joining the country club in some ways. I don't want to minimize it that much. That's not fair. But these were not guys who had the calling to be in the priesthood. These were guys who were military. This was a military order, unlike other monastic orders. These were fighting knights. And so you had to have a certain amount of money even to afford a horse and a page and footmen and all that kind of stuff. So you had to have a lot of money to do this. But the church essentially saw it as a really good way to not pay for the army themselves, but to have this army. And of course, the promise was, you can save your soul. We're gonna excuse you for whatever sins you might commit, because it's for the greater good. You're fighting, you know, the God's war over in Europe. In the Middle East, pardon me.
Yeah. Wow. So it wasn't that they were really talented, like really good fighters or anything like that. It was just
they were. Many of them, you know, many knights at that time were trained in jousting, trained in sword fighting. So yes, they were trained. Trained knights. They were skilled. That's what you did if you were a nobleman when you were a teenage boy. You trained to be a fighter on horseback, by sword, jousting, whatnot. So yeah, when they went over there, they were a vicious and feared fighting force because they were so well trained, and they had great success on the battlefield. No doubt about that.
Wow. Okay. So that's interesting. So you said that they had to remain celibate. So what happened to their wives and kids at the time? They just left them and they could never go back?
So the commitment was, I forget if it was a two-year commitment. It was, again, similar to today, you would join the army for a two-year stint or a three-year stint.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah,
an enlistment.
Enlistment was, and you'd go over and you'd fight for 2 years and you'd come back. And maybe re-enlist a couple years later, or maybe you wouldn't. You know, every situation was different. But whenever there were these wars in Europe, if you happened to be, you know, in France and it was time to go invade England, you were away for a couple of years probably anyway. You know, no matter where you were fighting, these wars happened. It took a long time, obviously. Transportation wasn't what it is today.
Mm-hmm. Now, this may be a sidebar conversation, but I just want to get this in there, get your take on it. I can't remember if it was Pope Pius or Pope Urban that began taking criminals out of their jail system and saying, listen, if you go fight, you know, against the Muslims, we'll forgive all your sin. And it's, your slate is clean.
Right. Now, these guys were different. These guys were foot soldiers. So they're up on the front lines. They were, you know, or they were the laborers or whatever. They were at the very bottom of the pyramid, whereas the Templars, who were noblemen and had their own horses and footmen and pages, they were at the top of the pyramids. But yes, there was a lot of that. You know, we'll forgive your sins, no matter what they are, if you go fight this fight.
Wow!
Wow! So there's hope for everyone.
Oh no! Wow! Okay. So now, What now on the new book? What are you pursuing? What's kind of your aim and focus in the new book that you're just putting out?
Right. So the book that's coming out, this will be the eighth in that series, and I call it my Templars in America series. And essentially, what it does is it, for the most part, looks at these sites and these artifacts. And it's not just New England. It turns out we've got sites and artifacts in the Catskills. We've got some stuff out in Southwest Arizona and New Mexico. It turns out these guys were getting around for the most part. And there may have been people here even before the Templars. The Irish, the Celts might have been over here in the 6th century. Brendan the Navigator is a legend. And maybe if you guys want to talk about that, I can come back on another time and talk about the Irish coming to America even earlier than the Templars. But this latest book is called The Swagger Sword. And essentially it's based on artifacts found in the Catskills that were left, we think, by the Templars even before Prince Henry, sometime in the late 12th century. There's some journals that indicate the Templars had come across and ended up in the Catskill Mountains and left these artifacts. And they have some interesting connections back to the Vatican. And you guys have probably spoken about the Vatican banking scandal from the early 1980s. So a guy by the name of Archbishop Marcinkus, who was sort of central to that banking scandal, it turns out was also looking in the Catskills for these same artifacts, which I think is a fascinating tie-in. My feeling has always been a high-ranking Vatican official is not going to go looking for Templar artifacts in America unless he's found something in the Vatican archives to indicate there really are Templar artifacts in America. He's not going to waste his time otherwise. I mean, very few people have access to the Vatican archives and library. He must have found something that made it worth his while to spend his later years traipsing around in the mountains of New York trying to find Templar treasures. To me, that's some of the most compelling evidence we have that this story really is true.
Yeah.
But my latest novel called The Swagger Sword ties in Marcinkus and this Templar treasure and the Vatican banking scandal. It turns out that a lot of these guys involved in the Vatican banking scandal were all given something called swagger sticks or swagger swords. They're sort of like, you know what I'm talking about? They're hidden swords that military guys used to use back in World War I. And
yes.
carved on the blades of these swords were clues and maps that led to this treasure in the Catskills. That part of the story is true. And we found a couple of these swords. But they were given to the different leading members of this this rogue Masonic lodge called P2, Propaganda Douay. And it was, again, a rogue group of Freemasons who had stumbled upon this stuff after World War II. And it's some really good stuff. Truth is stranger than fiction sometimes. But I like to grab some of this real history and weave it into some modern-day intrigue and then, of course, expose a lot of the real history as well.
Yeah. No, I think it's great. That's very important. We need to have more... more history, people getting more involved. I think that's great.
When I read, I love a good roller coaster ride where I learn something at the same time. To me, like historical fiction, that's the best. So that's the kind of stuff I write. Hopefully it's going to be a thriller. Hopefully you're going to enjoy the twists and the turns. But along the way, you're going to be like, wow, I didn't know about that history. That's interesting history. So it's one of those things that's sort of a guilty pleasure. You know, you can be entertained and be educated at the same time.
That's the best way.
Now,
I wish I wrote like that. Now, so how's your? How do people get a hold of you, and what's your website?
So davidbrodybooks.com. All the books are up there, and there's a link. You can get a hold of me that way as well. And as you can probably tell from the passion of which we've had this conversation, I will talk about this stuff to anybody, anytime, for as long as they want. You know, I love this stuff, so I'm always happy to chat. If people want to reach out to me, that's great. The books are on Amazon and on Kindle, the easiest way to find them. But again, David Brody, B-R-O-D-Y, books.com. And I try to make them inexpensive. The Kindle version is like $4 and change. So if you want to read this stuff, you know, I don't want people to have to spend a lot of money. I want people to be exposed to this. I want people to be passionate about it like I am. And so, go check it out. Kabbalah of the Western Night is the first one in the series.
Fantastic. Now, we're going to have everything linked up on our website as well and the stations.
Great. Thank you.
And you as well. So thank you for talking to us about all this. This is great. David,
Al, Kevin, it's been great. I really enjoyed you guys. Thank you.
David, it was astounding. Thank you. Thank
Excellent.
You so much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.